3718 Reel 4.
Let's say they were seaplanes anyway. It doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. A flying boat is a boat, you know, and a seaplane is an aircraft with floats,
right,
instead of wheels.
Okay, we're running.
We're running now. Here at West Guernsey, I flew all the while short 184 seaplanes. We had on that station 7 or 8. And it was necessary to keep at least 2 in operation every day. Otherwise, there was maintenance on the rigging, because they were a very big span and they had to be checked to see that all of the canvas or the cotton covering and the wiring and everything else was in order. The floats had to be checked. These were of 5 compartments each. They were very large, made of plywood, and they had to be examined after every flight to see that it hadn't been any undue strain anywhere. As far as the engines were concerned, these were very good indeed. They were 260 horsepower, 12-cylinder V, water-cooled. The radiator was separate from the engine and was stuck on top of it, almost projecting above the top of the top plane, and they had to be big because the engine was big, and the water cooling had to be quite efficient. That is to say, that the engine temperature had to be kept at a certain level, so it required a very big radiator. These had to be checked regularly. They were powered, as I say, by 12-cylinder V, twin carburetors, twin magnetos. There were 2 plugs to every cylinder. The whole idea being that if one magneto or one plug failed, the other would still operate. And on the whole, this did work, although, pardon me, in the course of my flying career at West Guernsey, looking back now, I had 3 occasions when the engine failed, when I was well out at sea, well out of sight of land, and nothing that I could do could keep life going in it, and I had to descend rather quickly, turning into wind, looking the way the waves were, which gave me the wind direction, and alighting on the sea, and then attempting to see what was wrong with the engine. But as it was up there, and the only way I could get at it was to get on the little accommodation ladder, which was a wire frame with small cross pieces in order to climb from the floats into the cockpit, it was very precarious indeed there, trying to examine what had gone wrong with the engine. It was found in every case subsequently that the cause of failure was over-oiling of the magnetos. Not that the engine overheated for lack of oil, but that there was a plentiful supply, so much so that it actually got into the magneto mechanism and in the end obliterated not only one magneto but 2, so that the engine coughed out in the end, and I had to take the necessary steps in order to get the aircraft down on the water without losing anything or without any damage to the plane itself. This, on these 3 occasions, I happened to do, but I suppose by custom and practice I got so used to handling them that there was no problem in getting them down without any power. Incidentally, in doing this, the observer in the back had to be shouted at to wind in his aerial, but unfortunately the aerial that we carried, which was about 150 feet of copper wire with a lead weight at the end of it, he couldn't wind it in time, so when the lead weight struck the sea below, it snatched the whole thing out, and there we were without any means of communication with a base. Our duty at Weskidon-Sea was to make patrols over the southern North Sea. We carried small charts on which were marked courses from base to a lightship or to a buoy or to another marker. And there were quite a number of sea marks still left in the North Sea. The lightships were remaining because they marked the main shipping channels, which are essential to our coastwise movements, which went on all during the war. And the marker buoys for shoals and at the ends of shoals and deeps were still left there. These were marked on our charts. So we had definite courses that we could set from one marker to the other, and this is the way we patrolled that area. This was carried in a small chart that I hung on a knob in front of me in the cockpit, and where the compass bearing was shown on these different legs that we followed in our patrols. All the time we were airborne, we cruised at anything 800 to 1,000 feet. It was not necessary to get any higher because we wanted to be able to see a certain amount of detail below. And if an enemy submarine appeared and there were certain areas in which our own submarines performed, where we would not mistake them for a German U-boat, but if it appeared, we wanted to be quite sure of identification before taking any action to destroy it. So we were the observers of anything going on in that area of the southern North Sea. Below us, occasionally, we might see a minesweeper, or we might see a naval craft of some kind, or even a merchant vessel following the shipping channel up the east coast. So there was plenty to look out for.
Of course, presumably you operated with warships from time to time, did you?
We didn't have any direct connection with warships. We did have liaison with operations from Felixstowe, where they flew twin-engine flying boats. So occasionally our patrols linked up with theirs, and on occasions we would carry out a sweep of that area, which we would designate a yellow patrol or something of that kind, which would be timed exactly so that our forces would meet at a certain place, patrol a certain area of the sea, and then disperse and go back to base. These operations are quite interesting because even in those days we used a certain degree of accuracy in our navigation. As a matter of fact, the observer who sat behind me operated the wireless communication system which we carried. This was done through a long copper wire which was trailed under the aircraft and held in position with a lead weight at the end, so that when we were in flight there was this long trailing wire underneath the aircraft, and this gave us communication with base up to a range of 60 miles, which was received on crystal, and we could send messages on one valve also that distance. Frequently when airborne, the observer would be listening through his headphones and playing around with his set, but often get German signals coming through. And I can remember on a number of occasions he would take the headphones off and put them on to me, saying, "Listen to this." And I would hear, for the first time, speech being conveyed by radio. German speech chattering away there, over in Zeebrugge, not very far away.
But your method of communication was the key, wasn't it?
Morse code.
Yes.
Our method of communication was Morse code.
When you had to do a forced landing when your engine failed, and you were out of communication because you said the aerial had been snapped off. How were you rescued? I mean, did they send out a search party?
There were three occasions when I was forced to land, well out of sight of land. On one occasion, it was somewhere near the Edinburgh Light Vessel, I think, which is out well out in the Thames estuary. But fortunately for me, although I didn't know it at the time, there was a surface craft not far away. And seeing a seaplane come down and descend on the water in that way, went out to investigate. So on the first occasion, I was spotted by a drifter, that is a fishing vessel that had been commissioned by the Navy to do minesweeping, and was taken in tow and towed back into Margate. On another occasion, I came down a good deal farther out. I think it must have been somewhere near the Tongue light vessel. I alighted on the water and just waited. There was nothing I could do. I just waited and hoped. And in the space of about an hour and a half, I was detected by a destroyer that came up and took me in tow and towed me into Margate. This was a tow of about 3 hours, I suppose. The most vivid one that I recollect was on another occasion coming down somewhere near the Galloper Buoy, that is well east of, I suppose you would call it the Harwich estuary, well east of that. I came down, and not very far from a shipping lane, and I just waited there. I don't know why, looking back, I seemed to take it all very calmly. The observer and I, we just felt this was our fate. We were there, and eventually somebody would come along and pick us up. We had no communication with the shore in any way, except that we did carry two carrier pigeons. Always carried these with us. And these could be released with a small message in a little metal capsule on the leg of one of the pigeons to say where we were. Actually, we never did this because on the third occasion, I remember, shortly after alighting, I could see in the distance a steamer going in a northerly direction, and it changed course and came towards us. On closer inspection, I could see that it was a Norwegian vessel. I think it was called the Dagmar from Christiania. And as it came near, I suddenly realized that there was a British destroyer in the vicinity coming at fairly high speed to cut off the approach of this Dagmar. And to my satisfaction, I was going to be rescued by a destroyer, not by a Norwegian vessel, and towed heaven knows where. The destroyer stopped speed some way off and lowered a boat, a rowboat, and in it was an enormous fellow, a coxswain, who had a huge tow rope in his hand. So he said, "We will take you in tow." I said, "All right, give me the line," because he wanted to put it round the floats. I said, "No, I'll fix this," and I tied it around the boss of the propeller because I thought this was a better place from which to tow. So we got down onto the floats, the observer and I fixed the controls. You could lock them in position with the rudder and the elevators and everything in a neutral situation, and took our haversacks that we carried with us with emergency rations, my chart, and the observer with whatever impedimenta he had, and we were taken by this rowboat to the destroyer. When we got aboard, I reported to the commander on the bridge, told him who we were, where we were from, and asked him would he send a message to the Nore, to the Admiralty at the Nore, to report our position that we were being in tow, and that he was taking us into Felixstowe, into Harwich Harbour. So that was done. And then I said to the observer, well, let's let the pigeons go now and see what happens. Having written a small message and put it on the leg of one of the pigeons, and we released these birds from the deck of the destroyer, threw them up in the air, and they both circled around and climbing as they circled, and when they got to about 200 or 300 feet off, they went in the direct direction that the compass bearing told us our base at Westcott-on-Sea was. We were entertained on the destroyer. We'd been out since before dawn. We were very hungry. And at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we were taken down to the wardroom and given a good meal. And I then asked the commander of the destroyer not to tow more than 12 knots. Otherwise, he might do some damage to the seaplane. So he proceeded at this speed, and eventually in about 3 hours' time, we arrived in the haven of Harwich and signaled to the air station on the north side of the haven, Felixstowe Seaplane Base, and they sent out a picket boat, took us in tow, and took us into the air station, up the slipway, and then I went and reported to the commanding officer who I was and what had happened, and would he kindly repair it so that I could fly back.
Now, this was, what, about summer 1918?
That's right.
Yeah. Mm. And you remained at Westgate until the end of the war, did you?
I remained there until, I think it was nearly May 1919. Because we didn't stop. They gave us different duties.
Even after the end of the war?
After the end of the war, we shepherded a lot of German submarines surrendering and coming into Harwich. They came over, quite a lot of them. And then we were employed to search the waters for drifting mines. And there were a hell of a lot of them at that time.
Destroy any with your machine guns?
We did, but we weren't successful. I didn't like it. I thought it was rather foolish in the end. We would land on the water, not too far away, and I'd say to the observer, now have a go. But either the bullets wouldn't penetrate. But if you sank the mine, penetrated the casing, the water got in and it sank, there was a hazard at the bottom of the sea. Still, it wasn't a sensible idea. It was far better to have them swept up by drifters and then defused and rendered harmless, rather than leave them out somewhere, either on the bottom of the sea. There must be a lot of things on the bottom still, you know, even bombs that didn't explode, still on the bottom of the North Sea. Whether they go off now, I don't know. I hope not.
Were there any particular incidents you can remember during the surrendering of the U-boats of the German high seas fleet on their way to Harwich?
There's nothing specifically that I can remember. We had a lot more information, of course, once the war was over than we had hitherto. I suppose, like other people, we relied largely on newspapers. What we had from the NOR and the signals came in frequently during the day were operational, more than anything else, not informative. So I don't think we had very much information other than what we gleaned, as civilians would have gleaned as well, after the armistice. But I've got a lot of photographs of German submarines in Harwich or as they were surrendering. And they came across a little bit north of our area, really, but they did eventually come into Harwich.
Now, unlike the big surface ships that went to Scapa Flow, I believe most of the German submarine crews were repatriated on arrival at Harwich, weren't they?
That is so.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. So you didn't have the sabotage.
We didn't have the, the complication of having all these men on our hands. Yes.
Because Harwich was a huge destroyer base at that time, wasn't it?
It was.
The photographs I've seen.
Yes. Well, after my being towed into Harwich, and of course it was reported to the CO at Westcott-on-Sea, I was there, and I was waiting for the aircraft to be inspected, the engine failure to be corrected, and to go back home. I wanted to get out. The observer and I came there, into the officer's mess. We didn't know anybody. We didn't have anything with us at all. We didn't even have a toothbrush. They had to bed and board us, in other words. And how they did it, I don't know. We had to go under the compliment in some way, I suppose, to justify the rations. And we had our meals in the mess, and we were given cubicles somewhere. I think they gave me a blanket. That's about all I had, and a bed. I wasn't complaining. I accepted it. This was part of my service that I was giving, and this had to be accepted. But we were just wandering around the air station. We didn't go ashore into Felixstowe or anything. I was anxious to get this bloody aircraft finished so that I could fly it back. And as I remember, I was there for 2 or 3 days and nights before eventually they got engineers on it to strip it down, find what was the matter, clean it up, and put it back into operation again, which they did. I imagine that they also provided me with petrol, sufficient to get me home anyway. There was a good bit had been depleted by that time. And eventually I got into the aircraft and the observer. Thank you very much, goodbye. Started the engine up, it went perfectly. I taxied it out into the harbour at Harwich, and I found the harbour was full of craft, destroyers, all sorts of craft in the way. I wanted a clear run to get off, and I really had to find a passage between all these anchored aircraft so that I could get off the water.
With anchored warships, you mean?
That's right. Mm. So eventually I took off and I flew back to base, just like that. It's quite simple.
Tell me a bit more about Westgate and its surroundings in those days.
We had a very pleasant life in Westgate-on-Sea. Here we were on an air station, never been built as that. We lived in civilian houses, a rather nice terrace it was, with big gardens, and beyond the gardens, the beach. So there were these 5 houses in a row which had been commandeered by the Navy, been used as a station in which the officers, which we were, lived in ordinary bedrooms. I shared one bedroom with one man, and I was on the 2nd floor in the middle house with a little balcony and a wonderful view of the sea. I was absolutely in clover, really. We had a mess on the ground floor, a very nice large room where we dined and had our social events. And we didn't have very rigorous discipline at all there. We didn't have to parade every day, as I remember. We were on call to fly. That was our function. The CO, Jerry Livock, was 21 years of age when I went there. So you can imagine the kind that we were. We were all about anything from 18 to 21. We did have one eventually who came to us, the second, Pierce. I think he was a very old man of 30. And I think he was married with 2 children who came there eventually and joined us. As far as life was concerned, we had our duties. We were on call. There was the occasions when we had time off. That was when darkness fell and we didn't fly. We could go off for the evening. We could go to Margate on the bus and come back at whatever time we liked, really. Some of the lads were very keen on finding a bird, as they called them, going to Margate and getting a fancy lady. The rest of us who were more serious-minded, I suppose, or have a different inclination, we'd play solo in the mess, or we would occasionally go to the theatre in Margate, or the cinema, because those were all functioning, and we could get in on the bus. The buses were running. Late at night, of course, one had to walk back. There wasn't any public service. I rather enjoyed my duty at Westgate. One got to know the local inhabitants. It was a very nice residential area with people of some standing and of comfortably off like the local dentist and other people that one got to know. And I did get to know one or two people in the village itself. The town hall at Westgate had twice a week, or three times a week, had dances to which the public could go by paying 1 and 6 pence or half a crown. And there was a band provided by the locals. And it was the old English form of dancing. I got quite keen on this, as did one or two others. And consequently, we got to know some of the local young women who would come to these dances looking for a partner. But that's the extent to which we went, I think. And other than that, I think the local library was working. I used to go and borrow books from it. So although there was a war on and rationing was very severe at that time, it certainly was. Even in the mess, we had rather basic stuff. Some of it was not very palatable, I'm afraid, but we had to accept what there was.
What typically was your diet? What was on the menu?
I remember some peculiar grey sort of stuff used to be delivered on a tradesman's van or a lorry, and we were told it was rabbit meat that the cook used to do his best with and make it palatable. Other than that, I think we did pretty well. And it was a small station. The discipline wasn't all that rigorous. Provided you behaved yourself, you could get by with almost anything. Whilst I was there, wrens had been introduced, and they were used to clean the aircraft, to serve a table in the sergeant's mess or in the cookhouse. I don't think we had any in our... No, we didn't have any in our mess. We did have the commanding officer of the Wrens. I forget her name now. She used to occasionally dine with us or have lunch with us. Other than that, there were generally about 12 to 16 of us having our meals there in the officers' mess. And with a small company like that, you got very familiar and got to know the others very well. On the whole, we were very modest in our demands. We were pretty well behaved, very rarely got drunk. And I think on the whole, we made the best of things. How's that?
Very good. No, not yet, no. We're running.
After the armistice, we thought everything was coming to an end. Everybody was talking about going back into civilian life, and all they wanted to do was to get out of it. We were told that we would continue to be used for patrolling the southern North Sea, and that our function now was to escort surrendering German U-boats, and beyond that, to search for drifting mines. This was a considerable hazard and menace, because so many had been sown by the British and the Germans in various places in this southern North Sea, and in the course of time they were bound to break adrift, and indeed they did, particularly after rough weather. So our function was to go and observe these from the air and report them back when suitable minesweeping drifters or other craft would come out and sweep them out of the way. So there was a great operation going on after the war in minesweeping, and we collaborated with these drifters and minesweepers below, reporting any mines that we saw. And in my case, I detected quite a number in various positions.